Go ahead. Let me know when you're ready.
This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, and it's April 25th, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Harold Covington. His website is Northwest Front, all one word, northwestfront.org. Harold, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here, Deanna.
There's one thing that I would like to know before we get started, and you are going to talk about National Socialism, mm-hmm. and the fact that probably Americans would readily accept it if they only knew what it was. But of course, we've been brainwashed for so long, several decades, that it was just the most evil thing in existence, and so people really don't investigate anything because they already have preconceived ideas about it.
Right.
Unfortunately. But let me just ask one question before we go into that topic. And that is, what was your relationship with Frank Joseph, otherwise known as Frank Collin?
Well, he was at one stage the head of the National Socialist Party of America. I was one of his associates. In 1980, we caught him doing things that he shouldn't do, specifically molesting young boys, and we turned him into the law, and he did 7 years in prison. It is interesting because this is the only time, to my knowledge, that the movement has successfully cleaned its own house. And, of course, needless to say, I never get any credit for that at all. But I understand that Colin came out of prison, and he is now working some kind of weird Atlantis cult out of his, you know, mother's basement in wherever it is he lives in Illinois. And that's about it. All of this happened, 33 years ago.
Okay. He actually contacted me last May. Mm-hmm. And said, "Oh, I would love to send you a book, and I would like to, with the implication that I would read the book and have him on my program." Well, I glanced through the book and I said, "Sure, come on, you know, I'll have you on my program." And then I started to do kind of a little background check on him and see what kind of person he was, who he was.
Yep.
And he was, and so I had him on my program, knowing what I knew about him. That he was associated with the National Socialist Movement. But I also discovered that he's a Jew. And so when he came on the program...
Were you ever able to get any actual reliable documentary
yes.
proof on that? Because, you see, all this was going on at the time, you have to bear in mind. And the problem was there was a lot of, shall we say... how can I put this? There was a lot of fraud going on. For example, one of the rival NS groups created so-called fake immigration papers for his father and this sort of stuff. And I have to say that, for all the sound and fury of the time, I have never seen any actual, hardcore, reliable, absolutely, totally, you know, correct documentation that Frank's father was Jewish, because there's just been so much, it's almost like the occult as a whole, there's just so much fraud and so much, advancement of specific agendas going on that it's almost impossible to tell, you know, what the thing was. The problem was that back then we were so also, you know, concerning ourselves with whether or not he might have been Jewish that we didn't pay any attention to what else he was doing. The Colin story is bad enough. I accept that this business about him allegedly being a Jew will go down in history as the accepted fact because, frankly, it's one of these cases where nobody cares about the truth. And for all I know, it may be the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But all I have to say is that I have never seen one single rock-solid, provable piece of documentary evidence that Frank Colin was a Jew.
Hmm. Well, I did a lot of researching, and I believe that he is, and that he He didn't actually serve his full 7 years in prison, but got out
early.
Yeah,
no, he got out early, yeah, right. That's, which actually is normal practice. Very few people who are sentenced to prison in this country actually serve their entire sentences.
Right.
Unless you're Bill White or Matt Hale.
So, right. There was Matt Cale, who I've interviewed on my program, was Rockwell's successor?
Well, he said he was. And the only actual documentation on that was a line in the last paragraph or so of White Power, which we later learned was added in later editions. No one was ever able to produce a document over Commander Rockwell's signature appointing Cale his successor. But all of this stuff is just generations old. I'm rather puzzled at this obsession we seem to have with things that happened 30, 40, 50 years ago, when in fact our race is now on the verge of extinction. You see, this is one of the reasons I now operate with the Northwest Front. We have to move on. We have to stop navel gazing. We have to stop this constant weird little incestuous recrimination that we engage in all the time over our past. You bear in mind, we're talking about groups of, a couple of dozen people here at any given time. Nobody gives a damn about what some little weirded out sect or other did 30, 40, 50 years ago. The murder of Commander Rockwell is an interesting, murder mystery, if you're into that sort of thing, but it happened in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
And, we have got to get out of this deranged obsession with the past and start looking towards the future.
Now, did you participate in the Skokie, Illinois, the attempted march?
I did. June the 25th, 1978, if memory serves. It was not a march in Skokie. It was a rally on Daley Plaza in Chicago, which we held as a sort of a celebration, if you want to call it that, of the Operation Skokie Supreme Court victory. What a lot of people don't understand about that, and I have to give Frank credit for this, he mapped out a very viable strategy there. What a lot of people don't realize is that it was never our intention to march in Skokie. Who gives a damn about marching in front of a bunch of Jews? The incident occurred when the Chicago Parks Department tried to stop NSPA rallies in the parks in Chicago by demanding some huge insurance bond before they would issue a permit, which, of course, is completely unconstitutional, and the ACLU got involved, and it took the case all the way to the Supreme Court, and in essence, the Supreme Court ruled that, number one, state governments or city governments cannot charge an insurance bond or put any kind of financial liability. Basically, in other words, they can't use loopholes in the law to try and silence free speech, and I can't recall exactly how this got worked in, but in essence what we got was a Supreme Court decision stating that specifically that the swastika and things like political uniforms were protected under free speech, just like campaign buttons and bumper stickers in an election campaign. It hasn't done us much good, but at least we got that decision. Operation Skokie itself is one of the few victories that this movement can ever actually claim, in the sense that it's a moral victory. But again, practically speaking, it's done us no good. And also, I have to say again, we're talking about a world that existed 40 years ago, and which no longer exists. We're moving into the 21st century now.
It did kind of cement the idea that there was a Holocaust, because Frank Collin mentioned during one of his speeches that Hitler killed 6 million and they should have killed more. And that was just about at the time that the Holocaust
That was probably just rhetorical.
But I see this whole operation as benefiting the story of the Holocaust.
Well, that's your opinion then. Now, I'm rather curious, Mrs. Mingola. Is the purpose of this call to talk about National Socialism,
yep,
or is it to try
yep,
and
I
get
just,
me to comment
nope,
on Frank Collin?
Nope, I just wanted to know.
I asked that because a lot of people, again, for reasons which I find baffling, are obsessed to the point of madness with Frank Collin and my association with Frank Collin and
well,
what happened in 1979 and 1980.
Yeah. I'm satisfied with your explanation.
I'll be quite happy to talk about Collin if that's what you want. If that's what you want to
nope.
talk about, because the Collin incident
well,
was
I really don't.
Part
I,
of the movement's history. Okay.
Right. I'd really like to have you tell us what exactly National Socialism is and why Americans would accept it if they only knew what it was.
Okay. Well, I'm a little rusty. I haven't done pure NS for a long time. Basically, National Socialism is a worldview for white people. It is based on the beliefs and the writings and the life and work of Adolf Hitler, of course. The National Socialism that is operative in today's world was kind of translated into modern English, if you want to put it like that, by the late Commander George Lincoln Rockwell of the United States. The best, I think, definition of the National Socialist worldview for modern times is contained in something called Cotswold's Manifesto from 1962. There was a meeting of National Socialists in Great Britain, including Commander Rockwell and Colin Jordan and a number of other, Franz Pfeiffer and a number of other lights of the movement of the time, and they produced a 7-point statement of the National Socialist worldview. But basically, it's a philosophy, a Weltanschauung, as it's called in German, a worldview for white people. The shortest way I can express it is in a kind of an acronym, which you'll see used in some movement publications, which is ORION, ORION, our race is our nation. That basically is what National Socialism is. It's the concept of the racial nation as opposed to the political nation with the land and borders and a specific government, and they can grant citizenship to anybody, including, you know, a one-legged Hottentot if they want. That's not a nation. A true nation is a nation of blood and not of geography. I tell people that National Socialism and, of course, our own independence movement here in the Northwest is a movement of blood rather than of faith, but it's also a movement of blood rather than a movement of geography. A racist, a National Socialist, is a pure patriot. Racism is, in fact, the highest form of patriotism, and National Socialism formalizes that. It has a whole historical and philosophical and metaphysical worldview that is based on this concept of race. Race is the primary aspect of human existence and is the most important thing in human affairs. So that is why liberalism and the Jews, of course, despise it, because basically the power structure of the world today wants all white people dead, and we want white people to live and survive and once again dominate the face of the earth. So you've got two diametrically opposed philosophies there.
Okay. Usually when I think of a country, I think of geographical restrictions and whatnot.
Most people do, yeah.
But nation would indicate people, and that's how it has been scripturally.
Now a lot of people do have a biblical interpretation of the term nations. Like, for instance, the Aryan Nations up here in Idaho was founded by the late Pastor Butler, and that's the interpretation that he used. He views all of the various Aryan peoples as part of a nation or multiple nations. It has to do with his religious outlook, Christian identity. The Northwest Front right now is not a National Socialist organization as such, although I am, and many of our better people are National Socialists, but we have, you know, Christian identity people, we've got pagan people, we've got Second Amendment sovereign citizen types, we've got tax resistors, we've got basically people who are just tired of, you know, the government's BS. We're building a broad movement among all of the white people of the continent here, or we're trying to, and so For that reason, we don't use swastikas or crosses or any specific symbol. Our tricolor flag is simply, blue, white, and green. But National Socialism is a force within the Northwest Independence Movement, and it's going to be a force in any kind of white nationalist movement that ever arises and becomes successful. You can't get around it. You can't get around the history of Third Reich and Adolf Hitler's movement and what the German people did for white civilization. In essence, Germany fought the Alamo of the white race. National Socialism is vitally important to the white man, and it was in the past, and it still is.
All righty. Now, so National Socialism, you've given a broad definition, but specifically, how would National Socialism benefit America? Now Hitler said that it was not for export. It was something that he did for Germany.
His German version of it was not. Hitler was a German nationalist as well as an Aryan racialist. I know Cale wrote a big long essay about, which was which, and points can be made on both sides there. But yeah, the NSDAP was a German and German oriented movement. Hitler himself really didn't think, I don't think, too much beyond the welfare and the moral and spiritual progress of the German people. He was very much a German, and he thought in German terms, and if you'd asked him what he was, first and foremost, he would have said a German. And so we get that. This is where Commander Rockwell comes in. Commander Rockwell basically was able to take the National Socialist philosophy and apply it in a much wider scale. Most National Socialists today outside Germany are what you might call Rockwellians or Rockwell National Socialists. That would include me, because our worldview is not just based on Mein Kampf. It's all the Old Testament. It's based on the New Testament, White Power by George Lincoln Rockwell. So, but you got to bear in mind, once again, I was talking a while back about, this obsession with the past. The world of the 1930s in Europe is a world that no longer exists in any sense of the word. I mean, Europe itself is now overrun with Muslims and other wogs and Nigerians and whatnot. I mean, that whole thing, it just, the amount of changes that Europe and the world have seen since the end of World War II is just, mind-boggling. And the world that Hitler grew up in, that he worked in, that he struggled in, again, just simply doesn't exist anymore. But his ideas, his principles, his theories, and his passion for his people, these are eternal. Those will survive that particular period. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff about the old NSDAP that was period specific. This is one reason why, even in the early days, back when I was wearing the costume, I understood that it was really kind of futile to dress up like 1930s stormtroopers in, Red Wedding in Berlin, because that was not who we were, that was not where we were. I cringe every time I see some kid on the internet calling himself a Standartenfuhrer or whatever like that, or trying to pretend to be a German, because it upsets me and insults me, and I think it's an insult to the men who actually wore the uniform and actually fought and died for the Reich. But again, I can't really fault these people who do this, like the NSM and whatnot. I can't fault them too much, because I used to do it myself. For about the first 8 years or so of my political career, I did it myself. And I understand why people like to do the whole Hollywood Nazi thing and dress up in costumes and pretend to be SA men. It might even work if we had, hundreds of thousands of members, but we don't.
Right. And what do you do to actually recruit people?
Well, for the Northwest, why, you talk about National Socialism or
For the Northwest Front.
Okay. Well,
I know I'm going off topic.
Internet, of course, but a lot of it's word of mouth. when we have people on the street, and we're actually starting to get some boots on the ground up here in the Northwest now. I complained a lot about this on my own podcast about how people aren't coming up here, but really, it's starting to happen. It's just not happening fast enough for my taste, but we do have some boots on the ground now. We've actually had some literature distributions in the past couple of months. For the first time, actual physical stuff, you know, off the internet. And that's important in itself. It doesn't matter even how many people we recruit. The fact is, for a brief moment, we're getting off the internet. And so we also, of course, do non-internet propaganda type stuff, like, for example, manufacturing CDs of my Radio Free Northwest podcasts. We send those out in introductory packets. We have a monthly newsletter called Northwest Observer. And actually, it's a small magazine. It's 16 pages. And we send that out every month. And we do have printed literature. In fact, I spent this morning rousting some of our people online as far as designing new leaflets go. We do have a line of leaflets, but they weren't really very modernistic. I designed them myself, and there's too much text, and I've been telling people we need leaflets with more graphics in it, that, so you know, all the Beavis and Buttheads out there can see pretty pictures. So we're starting to build up a actual physical literature line that can be hand-distributed by actual people. That's how I want us to recruit, face-to-face, person-to-person, not just, you know, doing things online or on a website, and, you know, having people show up in the form of email addresses, and you never know who you're talking to.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, right. I'm sure, I mean, you work internet yourself. I'm sure you've had instances where, you know, some guy's popped up on a message board or by email, and he sounds real good at first, and then it turns out it's, you know, the holy Rabbi Hyman Hebelbaum from Temple Shlakel,
right.
And he's posing as a, you know, racist to get a rise out of you, and all of a sudden you find yourself in, you know, the ADL or the SPLC bulletin and stuff like that. They
sure.
they like to do that. I don't know why they think it's funny, but they do. It's really ridiculous in a way, the way that the ADL and the SPLC and some of these liberal groups, these Antifa groups, react to us, because right now we're just not that much of a threat. And, you know, they've got to know that, but I guess we're kind of, you know, their bread and butter. I've often wondered what people like Mark Potok and Morris Dees would do if it weren't for us. I mean, they need us to make their billions of dollars.
Exactly. They need to have anti-Semitism in order to, as you say, as a fundraising kind of a thing.
Well, this is one thing you always have to bear in mind about the way our system works. Without Nazis, there can't be anti-Nazis. And there's big money in anti-Nazism, and there has been for, you know, generations, the SPLC being a good case in point. When you're talking about the federal government, you have to bear in mind, anti-terrorism is a major multi-billion dollar industry right now in this country. And without terrorists, there can't be anti-terrorists.
Right.
And if there was no terrorism going on,
you couldn't continue the war in the Middle East, and
yeah.
You know, without the Boston bombing, then we wouldn't have Muslims to hate, and then
that strikes me as odd. You know, all of a sudden these two Chechen kids who apparently are pretty much, well, the younger one especially, who apparently was pretty much completely Americanized, all of a sudden they decide to stick some explosives in a pressure cooker and go blow up the Marathon, and then they go running around like chickens with their heads cut off, and they get, you know, shot and killed and run down by cars and all this sort of stuff. It just, again, Franklin Delano Roosevelt once said, nothing is ever coincidental in politics.
Right.
And I am always suspicious when events like this occur and they are convenient for the power structure, convenient for Obama. So we'll have to see what happened there. But this is interesting because if it is an actual so-called Al-Qaeda attack or something, it's the only one since 9/11. I don't count that doctor at Fort Hood. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. He was just a nut, and he snapped, and he couldn't be part of an army anymore that was slaughtering his own people, and so he did some slaughtering on his own. Okay, that I can see as being pretty much as advertised, but if and then you get these things that the FBI sets up where they get some poor old Apu from down at the Quickie Mart and they surround him by about five agents and tell him he's in an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell, and then they talk him into doing a suicide bombing and they give him a bomb vest full of Play-Doh, and as he walks into the shopping mall or whatever, they arrest him. And they admit in court that they do this, that they set this guy up from the get-go, and the poor bastard still gets 25 years in prison.
Right.
But this isn't that. If this Boston thing is a genuine attack by Muslim extremists or whatever, it's interesting. It's the only one, to my knowledge, since 9/11.
Well, I think that there are too many people who are questioning 9/11, and they have mm-hmm. to reiterate themselves that we are under attack, that we have this external force, Al-Qaeda or whatever, that is still a faction. Still a factor
yeah.
in our continuing war, and the public doesn't really look into any of this stuff. They just believe what they hear on TV and what they see, and they really don't ever ask questions.
Well, I personally question whether Al Qaeda exists or ever existed. Maybe it did at one stage, but I like this business with them killing bin Laden. Okay, they go all the way over to Pakistan, allegedly assassinate bin Laden in his living room while he's watching cartoons or whatever, and they take his body away in a helicopter, and then, having taken his body away in a helicopter, rather than bring it all the way back to the aircraft carrier, they dump it in the middle of the ocean.
And then all the people in the helicopter die within a short yeah. period of time. Besides
yeah.
that, he died in December of 2001, so...
Yeah, I remember at the time that was pretty much that was circulated in the news media. He had, kidney failure or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's kind of hard to hook up a dialysis machine in the middle of a cave in Afghanistan.
Right. And that's why he went to the American hospital and was on dialysis there and was visited by the CIA in July of 2001, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they continue to do these false flag events, and I believe every war has been started by a false flag event, and it's profitable for a certain group of people. So anyway, getting back to the subject at hand, what are some of the things? What are some of the benefits of National Socialism that Americans would probably embrace?
Well, if you will go to our website at www.northwestfront.org, you will find on there a copy of our draft constitution for the Northwest American Republic,
okay.
which was
I'm
created
there.
In October 2006. Now, you will notice that there are certain aspects of that constitution which are very NS. In essence, what we've done is... we have created a modernized, updated version of a National Socialist State. Excuse me. If you read my Northwest novels, in several of them where we kind of get into the future where the Republic already exists,
we
mentioned the things like the labor service. For example, a lot of people say, well, Harold, if we get rid of all the Mexican immigrants, who's going to empty our garbage and pick our lettuces and work in my garden? And the answer to that is that young white people will, because as part of their national service, they will do time in the labor service, and they will haul the garbage and dig the ditches and plant the trees or whatever has to be done. So that is a very National Socialist concept.
Right.
I show our people up here Triumph of the Will, and that scene where the labor, the Arbeitsdienst people are doing the drill with the spades. I tell them, as we see that on the screen, I say, remember the labor service I was talking about in my novels? This is it. The Northwest Republic Constitution forbids usury. Period. End of story. It will be constitutionally forbidden in the NAR to charge interest on any loan of money. It forbids taxation on homesteads where white people and white families are actually living. The NAR may find it necessary at some point in time to have property taxes of some kind. We can't foresee the future, but it is constitutionally forbidden to tax a homestead where a family is living and where white children are being raised. We have some new wrinkles, which I personally think the Fuhrer probably would have approved of. The Northwest Front. That's not even true. The Northwest American Republic Constitution bans two classes of people who have caused immense trouble in society over the past 2,000 years: lawyers and a professional clergy. It will be forbidden in the NAR for anyone to accept money or anything of value for acting as an advocate or assisting in any way in a legal process, and it will be forbidden for anyone to accept money or anything of value for acting in the capacity of a clergyman. Basically going to make all these parasites, you know, do an honest day's work. And if you get rid of those two classes of people, just eliminate them from society, the amount of trouble you will avoid is just amazing. But there's a number of other National Socialist implications or tendencies within the Northwest Constitution. For example, I think one that, the Fuhrer would have approved of is that it is required that anyone holding the office of state president be a military veteran. That didn't come up in National Socialist Germany, because the Fuhrer was a military veteran, and just about every German man of that generation had served in the trenches. But that's another way to avoid problems, is when you have a professional class of politicians who have never actually served in the military. They keep thinking up stupid things for the military to do. So the Northwest Constitution is not a National Socialist document, but it is heavily influenced by the experience of the Third Reich and by National Socialism and by the life and work of Adolf Hitler. There's no question there.
Mm-hmm. You also have in Article 7, you have grounds for revocation or reduction of citizenship shall be mm-hmm. conviction of a felony, medically certified mental defect or insanity, proven non-white racial descent to include Jewish ancestry, so you do not allow Jews. Go ahead.
No, I was about to say, you're talking about classes of citizenship. That's another thing that's in the Northwest Constitution. It is democratic in the sense that there will be elections, but citizenship is divided into three classes. Third class citizenship is what you get when you complete your national service and you're ready to start life, you know, get married, go to college, etc. You get third class citizenship with one vote. Once you have reached a certain age, once you have achieved certain goals in life, maybe, say, produced three children or at least two children, whatever the requirements may be. I mean, the Constitution is not specific about these requirements, but whatever they may be, you get your second class citizenship, which gives you two votes. Now, if you are a sterling member of society, if you are a brain surgeon, a nuclear physicist, if you're a war hero with a couple of Iron Crosses, if you are a senior member of the parliament or you know, serious people, serious leadership, you know, cadre material, you get first class citizenship, which gives you three votes. And basically, this weights the democratic process in favor of the better elements of society. And by the way, that was the way it used to be in the United States Constitution as well, back in 1789 when it was first promulgated. But anyway, I just thought, when you're talking, quoting Article 7 there, I just thought I should explain to your listeners that that's what they're talking about, is citizenship or class of citizenship. And again, I consider this myself to be a very NS idea, so I've interrupted you enough, so go on.
No, that's okay. My guest is my guest. I'm just a facilitator here.
Yeah.
Number 5, factual proof of the commission of acts of homosexuality.
Yeah. I'm kind of getting into the area here of if I were king, I would do this or that, but I personally... Hello?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Okay, I heard a beep there. I personally consider homosexuality to be a form of mental illness. I hear a beep there. That is...
It's probably
somebody trying to call me, just disregard
it. Right.
Okay. But I personally consider homosexuality to be a form of mental illness, and in the NAR it will be treated as such. But it's not enough. Again, this is a horrible accusation to make against any person, especially a man. And my own, again, this is just my own personal opinion here, is that it would also have to be, you know, a criminal offense in order to keep it from spreading and keep it in the closet. Look, I mean, let's face it, there have been queers since the beginning of time. There probably will always be queers unless we can find some kind of genetic cure for it. We have to accept this, but at least what we can do is keep it so far back into the closet that it does not corrupt our youth or our culture. But for someone, in my view, to be charged in a court and convicted of this offense, there needs to be some kind of proof that an actual perverted act took place, not just, well, I don't like this guy because he looks like a sissy to me, or you talk with a lisp, therefore you must be a queer. You know, there's reasons for people talking with a lisp besides the fact that they're queer. And so, I'd rather there not be any witch hunts for, you know, people who, you know, just might look queer, act queer. In order to be convicted of the offense of homosexuality in the NAR, there would have to be some kind of solid proof of an actual homosexual act. And that's what article in the Constitution means.
Okay. Who wrote this Constitution? Was it a group of people?
Yeah, it was put together by a number of people. The people who made serious contributions to it would be well over a dozen, including some of the order prisoners, including David Lane before he died. So some of that Constitution is David Lane's work. There were, in fact, it took us almost 18 months to put it together. This is not something that I just sat down and tapped out one weekend on my computer. This is actually a group effort. They went through several drafts. There was discussion both on the internet and by mail with people like the order prisoners, Lane, Scutari, Bruce Pierce, and so forth. And so this is an actual interim constitutional document. What's going to happen, however the Northwest Republic comes about, there will be a period where the United States recedes and the forces of independence advance, and we will glom on to X amount of territory, whatever that, however it might work out, and we're going to need some kind of governing law or some kind of procedure whereby to establish the republic. Now, I describe this in my novel Freedom Sons as to how, one way anyway, that this might work, but that draft constitution is a key document, because that's what we slap into place as a patch, if you will, from the time when the United States collapses and the NAR is formally fully born. Now, what I envision is an actual, as part of the process of the Republic's birth, an actual constitutional convention similar to what our ancestors had in Philadelphia in the 1780s, where we will actually sit down openly, you know, personally in a meeting hall or the legislative chamber in Olympia or wherever we decide to use, and we will sort out exactly what we want in our Constitution. I describe this process in the first chapter, or the first section, I should say, of my fifth Northwest novel, Freedom Sons, which is about the first 50 years of the Northwest American Republic, the problems that the NAR would meet and have to overcome, so forth and so on. But in the first section, I go over the first year on a kind of a month-by-month basis, and as to how it might work out and various things they'll have to do, setting up a currency, establishing the Constitutional Convention, getting the details of national service sorted out, so forth and so on.
Now, do you have any territory as we speak?
Well, I got my computer. everything starts as an idea. I'm sorry to say that we're still in the idea phase. But I'm doing what I can as an individual. Right now, I've got my computer. I have got a small but growing group of very good people up here. The migration process is beginning. It is slow, slow, slow. I mean, if you listen to my Radio Free Northwest every week, me and Andy Donner are on there screaming, "Get your ass up here, get your ass up here." And we yell and holler at people, but it is happening. There are more of us here than there were this time last year, just not as many as there will be this time next year. My worry is that the process is simply too damn slow. I would urge everybody to go to www.northwestfront.org, look over what we've got, download a few Radio Free Northwests where you can hear me and Andy and Gretchen and some of the other people speaking about this, and think about starting to relocate to the Northwest, because if nothing else...
Why did you choose the Northwest?
Several reasons. First off, the Northwest has a deep psychic and metaphysical and spiritual connection to the racial movement because of Pastor Butler and the Hayden Lake compound. Those are important as a symbol because of the death of Vicki Weaver and her child, or her children, I should say,
okay.
In Ruby Ridge, because of the struggle of the order and the heroic death of Bob Matthews. But the Northwest idea is not mine, by the way. I did not make this up. As I tell people, if you want to get really hit the Wayback Machine, the first idea of a Northwest Republic was in the early 1800s when Aaron Burr and General James Wilkinson wanted to set up their own nation in the Louisiana Purchase. But in the 1940s, there was a move for something called the State of Jefferson in Northern California, because even then, the normal white people in Northern California were tired of living under that shower of excrement in Sacramento. And so... they were, matter of fact, the day they chose for their Declaration of Independence was December 7, 1941, and since the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor that day, that kind of upstaged them. But there's still a website on the State of Jefferson. I don't know why they haven't revived that movement and tried to get statehood, probably because Obama and the Democrats would never let them do it, because it would be another red state. But this idea of the Northwest Republic is not mine alone. It's not something that I originated, and I don't claim that. But there's another reason that we need the Northwest as opposed to, say, New England. There have been proposals for other migrations. Some people want to go to New England because it's still the whitest part of the country. We can't really do that because it's simply too close to the liberal power centers. Basically, New England is their little backyard where they like to go to play and have their summer houses.
Mm-hmm.
There is very little chance they'll ever let, you know, Vermont or New Hampshire or Maine go, because that's where their summer houses are. But, you know, Seattle and Portland and the Northwest, it's far away, you know, other than coffee, who gives a damn about Seattle. So, again, you've got to look at the mindset of a future American government who's faced with some kind of difficulty of this nature. But some people say that we should all settle in one little town in the Midwest, Kansas or Illinois or Missouri or Nebraska. And again, these areas, yes, are very white. Iowa's still very white. But then you're talking about enclaves, landlocked stretches of territory that could be surrounded by the enemy. We had a problem enough of that in Rhodesia. We were dependent on our South African lifeline, and when that was messed with, we had problems. Also, a new nation needs size. You can't have a small area like Peoria for a new nation. I mean, look at Gaza. Gaza is so damn small that the Israelis can effectively blockade it. We can't be living in enclaves where the government or the WOGs or whoever, the niggers, could blockade us, surround us, and choke us off economically. So that means that our homeland, number one, has to be fairly large, because we're going to have room to grow into. And secondly, it's going to need a coastline so that we can have access to the sea with deep water ports.
Well, a coastline can always be bombarded also.
Well, it
because,
could be, but
I mean, they've done that in Iraq. They did it in
yeah.
Germany.
Again, in my first, I hate to keep referring back to my books, but I deal with all these things in Freedom Sons. The whole, for example, in the 12th year of the Northwest Republic's existence, there is a concerted attack by the United States to try and reconquer the Northwest, and that's actually the longest section in the book, and I detail how this might happen, why it would happen, so forth and so on. And I did this to answer these people who say, "Well, Harold, we can never have our own country because the Washington, D.C. would just nuke us. Oh, they'd nuke us, Harold. It'll be so horrible. And just, you know, we are great at finding excuses to do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I mean, I deal with all these objections, sort of. Now, again, we don't know how it's actually going to happen, but I'll tell you this, it is going to happen. There's going to be a breakup of the United States. This thing can't hold together forever. It's like the poet W.B. Yeats said, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. There is going to be a Soviet-style bust-up of the United States, and we have to make sure that the white man gets a piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you not think that other races have been exploited by the criminal cabal?
Oh, sure. Other races have been exploited by a lot of people. I am quite willing to admit that blacks have been exploited for their labor by whites, by the old capitalist system, by the plantation system. I personally think that the worst thing we ever did historically in this country occurred in 1619 when those idiots at Jamestown traded 2 barrels of perfectly good sipping whiskey for 20 niggers. If we had just never brought these people into this country.
We really didn't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, there was the criminal cabal was the biggest, they were more active in the slave trading than the white people,
By criminal cabal, I assume you mean
I'm talking
the Jews.
About the Jews. They ran the ships, they owned the ships, they did all of the trading, they went to Africa, they brought them over, and they've exploited them ever since.
Actually, that's not quite the way it worked. It was the Yankee sailors and the crews that actually took all the risk of sailing to Africa with
okay,
the disease
but
and the storms and the
yeah.
Oh, no, the ship. Yes, I know. The ships were financed by Jews. The first one of the first Jewish communities in United States, what was the colonies at the time? There was one in Newport, Rhode Island. There was one in Charleston,
right.
South Carolina, both of which were centers of a small group of Jews who were, in essence, getting rich off the slave trade, what they call the triangle, but basically it was composed of molasses, rum, and slaves.
Right.
You got slaves in Africa, took them to the Caribbean and traded them for molasses, took the molasses to New England, got made or something like that. I can't remember now. It's interesting, though. That's another thing that a lot of people don't realize is the actual slave trade direct with Africa was outlawed by Thomas Jefferson, who was another president who wanted them to be sent back to Africa. But after that, most of the slaves that came into this country were not brought here from ships from Africa and marched down the gangplank in chains or anything like that. They came from the Caribbean and from Brazil, where they had actually already been slaves for several generations, which, slavery is slavery, but still, we have this image of, these ships pulling in and these, scarecrow-like blacks being herded off the gangplank in chains and been just kidnapped off the beach in West Africa someplace, and it wasn't like that. But, most of the slave trade was Jewish financed and Jewish controlled as far as the administration, as far as the profits go. It's just like I say, it was the Yankee skippers and the crews that took all the physical risk. But Jews have never been very good sailors. But I can't remember now. How did we get on to...
Oh, we were just talking about the triangle trade.
Something about the future of the Northwest American Republic. Why we have to have
right,
a coastline.
Right. That you want to have it all be white.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, yes. The Constitution prohibits the presence of any non-whites of any kind, and then specifically includes Jews. I have never really grasped this idea that some people in the movement have that Jews are white. They're not. Just because they got a pale skin, just like, a Hindu is... A Hindu may have a dark skin, just as dark as any Negro, but he's not actually a Negro. He's an Asiatic. when some people, including Negroes, ask me the difference, I'll tell them that's, well, you know, this guy Apu, you know, his skin's just as dark as yours, but he's not black in the sense you're black. He's an Asiatic. Well, so-and-so's skin may be just as light as mine, but she's not really white. She's an Asiatic.
Mm-hmm.
And that they can understand, but and it's not a bad way of putting it. Basically, Jews are Asians. They are an Asian people. They are genetically distinct. That's why their DNA can be detected in DNA tests and so forth. But they are not white people in the sense that we are, because it takes more than a pale skin to make a white person, to make an Aryan.
Mm-hmm. Do you assume that I'm an Aryan?
Beg your pardon?
Are you assuming that I'm an Aryan?
Well, I assume that since you're interested in National Socialism, you are.
I'm just teasing with you. I am. My background is English, Irish, German, English, Irish, German, and Danish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually am using Ancestry.com to trace my own ancestry back. I need to get back on that. I've tracked it back to 1822 now, which is where it starts getting dicey, because public records are, you know, start getting really slim about that time, especially in this country. England and the UK and most of Europe, they had a little bit more, but we're getting back into family Bible territory there. That was about the only record you'd have of births and deaths and, you know, who did what.
Well, you can also go into the probate records and that kind of thing. But as you say,
wills.
it does get a little bit more difficult. I kind of majored in family history and was very active in it for 20 years.
Yeah, in Britain you've got parish registers. You don't have so much in this country. But yeah, one of the great ways of tracking historic events, especially in medieval history, which is my forte, has always been wills, because our ancestors were very kept on wills, and you know, they would itemize everything.
Oh, absolutely!
In a will.
And the sales, the estate sales,
yeah, right.
They wrote down everything.
So you can learn a lot about what people left behind when they died. But like I said, but my ancestry so far, I found English, German, which I knew, and one Irishman named Kelly, which rather surprised me. I didn't even know I actually had any proper Irish. I mean, Scotch-Irish, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ulster Protestant. You know, my Covington side comes from the Ulster Protestants of... I do know that the Covington that came from Ireland came from Coleraine in County Antrim. I was able to find that when I was over there. But I didn't know we had any Catholic Irish, which I assume from the name Kelly, probably this person was. But apparently I'm also got an actual Irishman in there somewhere.
Good.
But to my surprise, but I mean, no Jews, no niggers, no Lumbee Indians. I was a little bit worried because my family comes from Robeson County, North Carolina, and you got a tribe of half-assed mulatto Indians down there called Lumbees. I was a little bit worried that one of my Robeson County ancestors might have been, diddling something red down there back in the middle of the 19th century, but no, none of it showed up. So, yes, Virginia, there is such a thing as racial purity.
Yes. I must say, I guess I'm very genteel, but I would never use the N word.
Now this is going to go on RBN.
Nope, it's not going to be on RBN.
Okay. All right. Well, there is a reason that I do that. If you don't want me to use it, I won't. I understand why a lot of people are.
Well, I probably should have said something before we started
that's
the interview.
Fair enough. Well, let me explain why I use the N word and the F word, and this actually is important.
Oh, don't use the F word, because then I'll hang up on you.
No. I don't mean that F word. I mean the one relating to homosexuals. Okay. But no, there's the thing is these are forbidden words, and what we're looking at here is Orwellian thought control through the use of language. Now, if you've ever read the novel 1984,
mm-hmm, I have.
When people are reading that for the first time or even rereading it, I recommend that they go right to the appendix about Newspeak, the corruption and the use of language for control of thought. The reason that we are not allowed to say certain words or even print certain words now on the internet in this society is because the powers that be don't want us to think these words, and they want to control the parameters of thought by telling us what terms we can use to express certain ideas, even in our own thoughts, and the way you do that is you make people so afraid that they might actually utter a certain word that they actually self-censor themselves. They train themselves not even to think such words for fear that they might actually let one slip and be subject to economic and possibly violent retaliation from some psychopathic monkoid that happens to be standing nearby. By the way, that's one of my favorite circumlocutions, monkoid. But it's an attempt by the system to control our thoughts by making it impossible for us to engage in racial, you know, heresy, so to speak, because we don't even have the thoughts necessary. We don't have the language to express such thoughts,
mm-hmm.
even in our own minds, because we're so scared that we might actually say it. So that's why I make it a point to, in my own podcasts, deliberately use these forbidden words, because I'm not just trying to, you know, make everybody crude or anything like that. I think this is a practice that we need to get back into in the movement, because if we, frankly, it's words and language like anything else. If you don't use it, you're going to lose it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have friends who are not white. I interview people on my program who are not white. I respect their skills. I respect their education. I respect them as human beings. So we probably differ in that respect.
Well, my view is that right now we are in a war for the white man's racial survival. The world is trying to kill us off. Right now we're less than 8% of the world's entire population. White women of childbearing age are less than 3% of the entire world's population.
Oh, I had no idea it was that low.
My view is that, fine, let's make sure we survive. Let us get a piece of territory for our own in the Northwest. The Northwest Republic is a homeland for all white people. Once our racial survival is assured, once we are sufficiently armed, both with weapons and with knowledge, to make sure that we can survive, once we have the weaponry back in our hands, in our holsters, so to speak, so where we can command respect, then we can talk about respecting other people and of other races and so forth and so on. Then a little bit of liberalism in that respect maybe is something we could afford. But so long as we always keep our hands on that pistol at our side, because this is essentially what's happened. We've given up control of the, we've lost control, I should say.
Yeah, I don't think we ever gave up any control. I think it was seized by the upper
echelon. No, we let them do it. But we've lost this is why a lot of people wonder why on my own podcasts I bait the cops and I say, you know, provocative things to FBI agents on there. Number one, I know they are listening. I can tell from our stat counter, which tracks, you know, where certain hits come from. But cops, FBI agents, military, these people are essential to the whole problem. Without these muscle men to keep Obama and the Democrats in power, they wouldn't last a week.
So you think it's just the Democrats? Or you...
Well, that's convenient. If you really want to describe the system, you've got to go into, well, the liberal, Zionist, plutocratic, Illuminati, conspirators, blah, 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 blah. And see, most American people just don't get that.
Mm-hmm.
They say, oh, what are you talking about? Oh.
Well, I mean, the Republicans are just as dangerous as...
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's another problem I have. I use Obama and the Democrats in sort of everyday conversation. Yeah, because, see, that's what a white man is going to get. a white man on the street or in the Safeway or in the job or in the workplace is going to understand that the people who are screwing him over immediately, people who are bringing in Obamacare, causing him to lose his job and lose his hours, mm-hmm. etc., those are Obama and the Democrats, because mm-hmm. he sees that on his TV. That he can understand.
Okay.
It's not a total oversimplification to say that it's Obama and the Democrats. They're certainly the tip of the spear, so to speak, mm-hmm. but they are the visible face of the problem. Now, I agree that people, white people especially, do need to be educated as to the entire depth and nature of the problem. Yes, eventually white people need to learn about Illuminati and Zionists and insiders or mm-hmm. you know Rothschilds and all this sort of stuff, but you have to understand that to the average man on the street, that just sounds like gibberish. They mm-hmm. don't know what you're talking about because they have been denied the necessary knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So I simplify things a lot by saying, well, it's Obama and the Democrats doing this. And yeah, that makes me sound like I'm a Republican. So I try to throw in a few disclaimers. I mean, you know, I have not forgotten 8 years of George W. Bush. Don't worry. My blog, my personal blog, was founded back in those days, and it's called Down with Jug Ears. DOWNWITH. JUGEARS, Down with Jug Ears, all one word, at blogspot.com. So, you know I was no fan of George W. Bush. I mean, the man was a drunken imbecile.
Mm-hmm.
And he's responsible for a lot of the problems today. So, believe me, I do not let the Republicans off the hook.
Okay.
But sometimes I do simplify it by saying Obama and the Democrats, Obama and the ruling party, because especially with Obama being black-ish, we now have a dark face to the problem, which I think is a help.
Mm-hmm. Of course, his mother was Jewish.
Yeah, so I heard.
Yeah. All righty. Well, it's been very interesting talking with you.
Okay. Is this going to go on? Send me a URL, and I'd like to, if possible, once this goes on the air, I'd like to download it, and with your permission, I'd like to. I tend to edit these downloads to get rid of a lot of the E's and the U's and
oh.
the like, you knows and
the you knows.
Sort of yeah, right.
I
okay.
have a little a little post-it note on my monitor. It says, "Do not say or you know."
Right.
But I invariably do it anyway.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I would like to clean it up a bit and maybe upload it to my own site, and I will give you credit, you know, of course, and a URL for the. And I'll also send out a notice to my own list stating, okay, I appeared on the, what is it, the Deanna Spingola Show?
Just Spingola Specials. And
okay.
I will send you the URL. And
okay.
In fact, I can send you the audio file via email, if that's.
Yeah, if it's, now I got Earthlink. Earthlink is a little bit tetchy about any attachments than 10 megabytes.
Okay.
If you can upload.
I'll just upload it after we're done here, and then I'll send you the URL.
Okay. You can use sendspace.com, but whatever you want to do.
Okay.
Okay, but look, I appreciate it.
Well, like I say, it's been very interesting.
And now, serious question. Is there anything else you would like to know about the whole Frank Collin incident? Because just to make it clear, I have no objection to speaking about this. I personally think I don't get enough credit for doing what I did, but the only problem I have with a lot of this stuff from the 80s and 90s, like I say, it's in some cases it kind of develops into a weird, unhealthy obsession with some people. But, I mean, in this particular case, what we did was we put a child molester in jail.
Which I, yes, and that's
and
where
I,
it should
I have
be.
No problem with that at all, and if anyone asks me about that Collin thing, I'll just simply tell them what happened. It's unfortunate. We have always had a problem in the movement attracting certain people that don't belong here. We have had a very serious character issue. In fact, on my February 21st podcast this year, I devoted an entire Radio Free Northwest to the issue of character,
mm-hmm.
Of white character. So if you're curious about what I feel about that particular issue, if you want to take the time, it's about an hour, you can download that one and listen to it, February 21st.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the only thing I see him as being, I think he was an infiltrator, And I think that he tried to actually decrease any kind of respect for the movement. And I think he was also instrumental in giving the Holocaust legs, so that, because 1978, then in 1979, you had the President's Commission on the Holocaust, and it took off from there, and I think that he helped it, whether he meant to or not, but I think he did mean to, and I do kind of believe that he is Jewish.
Yep. Well, I mean, it's
It would make sense. I mean, he had the character, and certainly benefited that whole thing, the whole Holocaust thing.
Well, like I said, I mean, I'm tempted to say we're talking about ancient history here. The trouble is, he's still around. One of the things that stuns me is the fact that we as a movement seem to have no moral compass at all, and it doesn't matter what you do, you can always come back. I mean,
well,
Glenn,
you know what?
Miller is coming back, for God's sake.
But you know what? After I exposed him on my program, I don't hear him on any alternative radio programs. And he was trying to infiltrate the so-called truth movement, and I don't think that he has been able to do that.
He's trying to come back. Yeah.
Yes. And
it's the one thing, and I can, in a way, it doesn't even necessarily mean that he's some kind of infiltrator, because I understand that little the white racialist movement, the white nationalist movement, is like potato chips. It's addictive. And once you get a taste for it, I mean, I can understand why people are constantly dragging themselves back, no matter what kind of bad experiences they've had with it, because it's just once you know that there is a place where you can actually, you know, speak freely and actually, you know, get into forbidden ideas like that, or maybe it's just the whole ambiance, I don't know, but I've noticed that about our movement, not just the ENS movement, but other aspects of it. It's just like we're addictive. People, once they get a taste, they just can't stay away. I think this is what the case is with Miller. He just, you know, can't resist the
urge not familiar
to try
with
him. Well, you didn't miss anything. He's a guy who he ended up testifying in not one but two capital cases against his own people and spending 10 years in the witness protection program, and now he's trying to come back on VNN, or he did come back on VNN, I should say, but long involved story there again, and I'm guilty now of doing the same thing I criticize others for doing, which is getting obsessed with the 80s and 90s. Okay, well, like I say, send me the URL, send me the link.
I will.
I'll see what the finished product looks like, and assuming you don't, you know, make me out to be a total fool, we can do it again sometime.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Harold.
All right. Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay.